Session number 26359, Colonel David Robbins, Reel 1.
Robbins, Reel 1. Can you tell me, first of all, where you were born?
I was born in Pune, India.
And what did your father do?
My father was in the Indian Civil Service. That's a bit.
Carry on.
No, I was just going to say, and he was stationed there at that time. Although he was in the First World War, and then he came back. And I was born in 1918 in Pune.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
No, I was the only child.
And your mother was obviously living out there?
Yes, she lived out there.
Did she work or get involved in
no.
the community?
No.
So where did you go to school?
I went to school, I brought back from India when I was about 7 or so. Went to a prep school somewhere near London. And then I was sent to a school in Cornwall, Truro, because my father knew a Methodist, a priest very well, and decided to send me to Truro rather than to King's Canterbury or Marlborough, which were two other options. I was very sorry I went to Truro, because it turned out that it was what amounted to a pacifist school. It disagreed with the combined cadet force and anything to do with the services. On the other hand, it was a very tough school, discipline-wise. And I stayed there for a long time, 1928 or 27 to 1936. In that time, I saw my father once every 4 years, when he came on leave from India. And my mother once every 2 years. Therefore, I was farmed out to relatives. And on one occasion, when it was not convenient for anyone to have me, I even spent the whole of a summer holidays at the school, which was very unpleasant. However, in the end, I became the head boy of the school, captain of the rugby 15, and so on.
What was the school called?
Truro School. Right. And the other day I visited it, 2003, because there was a wedding down there. I visited the school, and it has grown to 900 from 400, and has beaten certain schools like Eton and Sherborne in rugby, and has a very high academic record, but it is still, in my opinion, a pacifist school, and I asked them that question. A great pity.
Did you have an interest in the military when you were at school?
Yes, I always wanted to be a soldier from my earliest days, as far as I can remember.
Was that from your father's influence?
Yes, and also one moved with a lot of soldiers, and that was one's life. Mm.
What was your father's job in India?
He was the in the Indian service, in the military accounts department, the director of that in the end.
Uh-huh. So you were very much involved with the military?
Yeah, the whole time.
Yeah. Was it a very lonely time for you at school? Did you feel...
Yes, it was a lonely time. I had one or two good friends, but it was a lonely time because one was literally on one's own. And they were very surprised when I decided I was going to take the entrance exam to Sandhurst.
Did they disapprove? They
didn't try and put me off, but they didn't help me a lot, which meant I had to do all the work for myself, and I did. And I went up to London and was interviewed, and the interviewing board, an admiral, a general, and so on, couldn't understand how I had never heard of the combined cadet force. And they couldn't understand why I should want to go into the service from a school like that. So I didn't do very well on the interview marks, but I had done well on the written work.
You were strong academically, were you?
I don't think I was strong. I just worked very hard and crammed very hard. And I passed in 68th, despite poor interview marks. And that was 68 out of 200 plus. Everyone was very surprised. The school was quite pleased in the end. But I was the only one between the two world wars to go to the services. Of course, when the war came, they were good chaps and they all volunteered and many were killed. But after the war, they reverted to no CCF.
So, you arrived at Sandhurst. What was it like? Was it anything like you'd expected?
It was absolute murder for me.
Why was that?
Because I was in a very strange environment. It was run by sergeant majors on the square, officers teaching one, everyone in uniform, and all my colleagues all had been to schools who sent people to Sandhurst and the Navy and so on. As a matter of course, I didn't have a hard time because of that.
And I suppose you hadn't done the marching and
all. I hadn't done any of that, so I had to, I had a very hard start. The only thing that saved my bacon in a way was that I happened to have been taught how to play rugby at this school I was at. And very quickly I got into the Sandhurst teams. I played for Sandhurst. And that earned me some marks.
What was the sort of daily regime like there? Do you remember the sort of timetable?
Yes, you got up very early. You had your own room and you had a servant. And in those days, one's parents had to pay for you to go to Sandhurst. Nowadays, it's free. Not only free, but you get paid to go there as a soldier. But in those days, it was about £300 a year, I think, or a term. Whatever it was, I was told it was just as expensive as Eton for one's parents. So we had this room, and we had a servant, but one had to clean one's own boots and kit and uniform and weapons, rifle, and the slightest speck of dust or anything on anything. And you got extra parades and extra work. One got up pretty early, 6:30, and went straight on to parade, having shaved and dressed and done. Well, it was a very rigorous inspection on the parade.
How did the NCOs treat you?
Very severely. There was a lot of shouting and a lot of severity. Never would I put it, however, as bullying in any way. Never. It was just hard. And that was very good for one. One was going into a hard world. And although the officers had a pretty reasonable time, they still had to do as much as their men and more when it came down to it.
How did you get on with your peers there? Because they had been to very different sorts of schools, hadn't they?
I made many friends with my in the end, because one had similar interests. I liked riding. I liked sports. I made some good friends there who exist to this day, those who are alive. It was a very good relationship, and one had 18 months of it. But it was hard. Without doubt, it was very hard. Of that, I'm glad.
Yes, So that was your sort of introduction to the army.
That was my introduction.
And at the end of the 18 months, how qualified did you feel to go off and lead men?
Well, I felt a very different person in many ways, physically, mentally, and I felt apprehensive about joining a regiment. And in those days, you had a choice of three regiments. I chose the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry because I suppose I lived there. I chose the Wiltshire Regiment because I had some friends or relations who had once been in it. And really, as a joke, I chose the Coldstream Guards merely to upset my Sergeant Major, who was in the Coldstream Guards and who objected to his regiment being put third choice. For that, I was marched up in front of the company commander for insolence to the regiment, which was showed you the sort of world we lived in.
So, after your passing out at Sandhurst, was that quite an occasion, the passing out?
There's a tremendous parade when you pass out. And someone like the king, or someone like that, quite often takes the salute. And in those days, the adjutant was on a horse, he may still be. And the horse used to ride up the steps into the old building. And it was a long parade, and the band, and it was a very grand occasion. And you passed out and went on a month's holiday with notice by then of which regiment you'd been allotted. I was allotted to the Wiltshire Regiment, who was stationed in Catterick at that time. One battalion was in Catterick, that was the second, and one battalion was in India, in Bangalore.
Now, this was 1939,
This was 1938, August 1938, I joined my regiment.
Yeah. So, lots of talk of war, I imagine.
There was a lot of talk of war, and one wondered whether it would be. And I remember my father had come home on leave about that time. And he was a very hard, severe, disciplined man. I remember him saying goodbye to me, and he, tears were in his eyes. He said, "You will never really wear that mess kit. You won't wear your uniform for long because subalterns go to the war and are killed very early." I was amazed that he said that. We said goodbye, and I went off to Catterick, and he finished his leave and went back to India. And when I joined Catterick, the 2nd Battalion, it was as gruesome as I thought it would be.
Right. Tell me about arriving at Catterick, as you're a very green young officer.
A very green young officer. Yes.
And it's quite a formidable sort of place, isn't it?
Very formidable. I remember, I think we arrived at Richmond Station. Now, that's when I arrived myself in a car. My father gave me his old car. And I arrived at the mess, which was a First World War wooden hutted camp called Hooge Lions. And the battalion was very depleted, having just come back from Palestine, where they had been under an adjutant who was eccentric and, I suppose, brutal would describe him.
Really?
Brutal. And he was assisted by a regimental sergeant major who was equally disliked for his revolting hard treatment of the men. As a result, many men either bought themselves out or left that battalion. And when I joined it, instead of being 600 or 700 or 800 strong, it was 250.
That must have been a huge issue then. Lots of people had left.
And it was a huge issue, but why they should leave with the war looming, I do not know. having left, of course, and when the war came, they were all called back.
So you arrived to all this talk of the bad times that have been had in Palestine. What exactly had gone wrong? Was it just general sort of bullying?
That is one place where I'd say there was bullying by this particular adjutant. Who was just very inclined. He was very, very unpopular. And no one liked him. I remember once at a regimental officer's mess dinner, he was beaten up. I remember his leg was broken. Rough days.
What was his name?
His name was Keeble. Mm-hmm. And... when the war came, he went out to Cairo in a staff job, and I don't think he ever saw a shot fired. And he rose to brigadier on the intelligence in Cairo. And there are many stories about him there, but it's not rather boring, really. But he came to a sticky end in the end.
Did he?
After the war, he somehow got command of the Wiltshires, but he blotted his copybook by being caught black marketeering and other unofficer-like behaviour, and was moved. He died shortly afterwards. I dwell on him like that because I have not nice memories of him.
So that's the sort of atmosphere that you arrived
in Catterick, yes, into that unfortunate atmosphere.
So who were the other officers then?
The other officers, well, they were there, but in those days it was the custom that a young officer was not spoken to, possibly for 6 months.
Not spoken to by other officers?
By other officers.
Why was that?
That was the system. And you went in, for instance, to breakfast. There might be a major sitting there. You'd say, "Good morning, sir." He either wouldn't answer or would grunt or ask why was it a good morning. If there was a pot of marmalade in front of you, he would turn to the servant and ask him to go around and get it rather than say to you, "May I have the marmalade?" There was no talking at breakfast, and there was no talking to us. Cold days, I remember, and fire in the anteroom. You wouldn't dare go and stand near the fire. That is for majors, people like that.
So you joined up with some other...
I joined up with two others, yes, yes.
So you had some support there?
Oh, we had some, yes. We got together.
So how did you get on with the senior NCOs? Were they the people you had most contact with?
No, I didn't have most contact with senior NCOs at all. I just had an understrength platoon. And at that time, 1938, I was amazed that we still weren't armed properly. You'd have thought with war on the horizon, you'd have been fully equipped. We were not.
So what sort of arms did you have?
You sometimes had a wooden machine gun on an exercise, pretending it was there. I cannot state how unreal the situation was.
Because these men had been in Palestine, doing a real job there.
Yes.
And, I mean, they had quite a lot of, saw quite a lot of action, didn't they, with the... keeping the peace and so on.
Yes, they did.
How did they feel about having wooden machine guns?
Well, they had arms out in Palestine, of course. But I don't know. They were bewildered, I suppose. And then about the end of 1938, this adjutant said to two of us, "I'm fed up with you. I'm sending you out to India." And we went to India.
Right. And this was with which battalion?
And we went from the 2nd Battalion in Catterick to the 1st Battalion in Bangalore, India.
Right. So what were your thoughts at the prospect of going to India?
We were delighted to go to India.
Because you knew it anyway.
No, not because of that. Yeah. Not because of me knowing it. Yeah. But because anything to get away from this ghastly lot in Catterick, which was a very unpleasant area, especially in winter. All I did there, I did play some rugby for the regiment and the army a bit. And I also was able to hunt a bit. They were very nice there, the hunts, the Beedale and the Zetland. And they let us hunt for very little money. That was all right. But I was glad to go.
How did you travel out?
We went to Southampton, where we got on a troop ship. And in those days, it was a grand occasion. Troop ships leaving Southampton, which was a great port in those days. Great shipping lines were there. The biggest ships in the world went. Now, Southampton is just a shopping centre with no ships. And when we got on this troop ship, there were two military bands on the quay playing us off. And we marched, various soldiers there as well. They had to go. It was a quite a nice troop ship, I seem to remember.
Your accommodation was comfortable, wasn't it?
It was all right, yes. It was four in a cabin, and the troops were pretty miserably in hammocks in down below decks. In those days, it was over 3 weeks' journey to India. And we went through the Mediterranean, Gibraltar, stopping at Gibraltar, Port Said, Aden, Bombay. Quite a trip. And one did as much training as possible on board. And there we were in February 1939. And we then got on a troop train, or a train, at Bombay, which was a day and a half journey across country. Very comfortable for the officers in first class compartments. And we had servants allotted to us then, bearers. And it was a very comfortable trip. We had all our khaki drill and all that made already. Although when we got to the battalion, it all had to be made again because it was wrongly made in England. And there we were. We got to the 1st Battalion where the adjutant was a very different cup of tea to the last one, as was the CO. And there were about 900 men, 800, 900. And it was in a real army, as it were.
So what were your duties? What duties were you given?
I was given a platoon to command, which is about a sergeant, three corporals and 30 men. Mm-hmm. I was also made the horse transport officer because someone said I had ridden a bit. And I had 20 mules to look after and 8 officers' chargers, as well as being a platoon commander in a rifle company. And we lived in bungalows, and I remember one of the bungalows we lived in, I think Winston Churchill had lived in it was the same. It hadn't changed much from the 1890s. Thatched cottages, about 3 or 4 officers to a bungalow, a large, comfortable officer's mess, big garden. Each of us had a servant, and things were pretty luxurious.
So how did you get on with your senior officer? Can you tell me about him?
Do you mean the commanding officer?
Yes.
The commanding officer was a bachelor, I remember. His name was Seagrave. And his brother was Major Seagrave, the famous racing driver who'd won prizes.
Yes.
For some reason I got on with him. He let me ride his horse. I used to exercise that a lot. The adjutant became a friend of mine later, but he was a very good adjutant, a hunter. There was an officer there called Lord Seymour, who's the son of the Duke of Somerset, and he came into our regiment. At that time he was ADC to the local governor. And one of my best friends, Mickey Thomas, I remember he was there too.
So it sounds a very different atmosphere.
Totally different, and a totally different world. And I was quite happy.
So what duties were the 1st Battalion undertaking then?
Well, internal security, we were keeping the peace. Those were the days of Gandhi when there was civil disobedience, there were strikes. One had to go out with platoon to clear crowds. And one had learned certain drills, and it was not an onerous task. One didn't have to do it often. But that was that. We did 6 weeks training out of barracks, went out into the jungle and hills, and that was about it.
So had the training that you'd done at Sandhurst, had that equipped you to do all these things, to be able to undertake all the procedures and the tactics and so on? I mean, had it been comprehensive enough training, as it were?
The training at Sandhurst, I suppose, really was a training of discipline and how to be an officer and how to conduct yourself in the military world. It hadn't at all trained one for the life in a battalion in, say, India. And why should it? It was all right. But, of course, while we were in Bangalore, on September the 3rd, 1939, war was declared.
How did you hear about that? How did you get the news?
We heard about it on the radio news. And in those days, it was very... communications were very difficult. You couldn't just pick up the telephone and speak to someone easily at home. I remember sending one or two signals, telegrams. That's how one communicated back, saying to people I'd got in touch, friends with in England, I hope all's well, or whatever one said. And we hope we'll be back soon.